What's it all about?
What?
Everybody's dead. I feel like a dinosaur. Oh, I know how people think of me these days. Old-fashioned, outmoded.
Well, not after this picture, they wouldn't.
You can't change a whole lifetime with one picture.
What have you got if you quit?
Oh, Sammy, what's the use? Mr. Boogeyman, King of Blood, they used to call me. Marx Brothers make you laugh. Garbo makes you weep. Orlok makes you scream. And once I thought I'd be an actor. Oh, it's not that the films are bad. I've got bad. I couldn't even play a straight part decently anymore. I've been doing the other thing too long.
Of course you could.
And even that isn't the point. You know what they call my films today? Camp. High camp. Wait a minute, I want to show you something. My kind of horror isn't horror anymore. There they are. Look at that. No one's afraid of a painted monster.
The only thing you've said that's right is about this. Which is why you ought to do my movie. You don't play some phony Victorian heavy. You play a human being, and you could play the hell out of it. If I were your age, I'd play it myself. I'm gonna go offer it to Vincent Price.
This is the emergency podcast system. This is not a test. Movies are bombing all over the country. They are posing as movies you already know. They may already be in your theaters, your neighbor's home, or even your own. Do not panic. Specialists have been dispatched. They will help you identify these pretenders and defend you against this invasion of the remake. Please stand by for further instructions.
Welcome to the Invasion of the Remake podcast. I'm your host, Jason Bishop, and with me today, as always, is Sam Stepanenko.
Good day, afternoon, evening, whatever time you are listening to this.
And Trish is swimming with the fishes.
Again? Still?
Still. She'll be back. She'll be back by the time you hear this.
She should be, yes.
Yes. And she did watch last week's episode of Pete's Dragon, and she did watch Targets, and hopefully she'll be sending us some little extras, and I think we'll post it on our social media.
That would be fun.
Yeah. So if you want to hear the extras, you got to be following us at Invasion of the Remake on Twitter or Invasion of the Remake on Facebook.
Yes, or Instagram. I think we can even post it there.
Yeah. So now's a good time to start following us on our social media so you can get some extra content. These are like bonus features on our episodes.
Yes. And it's not even Patreon, so you don't even have to pay for it like you would on
still,
Patreon.
Still 100% free. How do we do it? We don't. I take a loss. I pay for all of the hosting fees off my credit card. So hobbies cost money.
Yes. Show your appreciation by liking and sharing with everybody you know.
Please do. Please do. I thank you for listening.
Yes.
Today we're going to do something we've never done before. We're going to start this episode off with a little bit of a warning, because this tackles some heavy and disturbing subject matter that we're going to be talking about today.
Something that's very sensitive in media and just in general with the public right now. Yeah, absolutely.
Yes, yes. So we're going to be talking about gun violence, and mostly towards this film, but we want you to be aware that we are going to be talking about these subjects, and some people are sensitive about these subjects, but sensitive subjects need to be talked about. So, fair warning, it's the only time we're probably going to do it. We're already clearly labeled explicit on our content anyway, through our providers, because we like to drop F-bombs from time to time. But we want to give you this extra heads up, because there's definitely some disturbing contents within this film that might bother some people, and we're going to be having frank discussions about gun violence at some point. It's inevitable in this episode.
Yes, yeah, and it's a really important part of this film, and we don't want to upset anybody, but at the same time, it's I think that what I think we have to say is important too.
Yeah, absolutely. As important
and what the film has to say is important, I should say.
Exactly. This film is still important. Targets from 1968 by Peter Bogdanovich.
Which we've never covered before, surprisingly.
Oh, he hasn't directed as much as I thought he had.
He's acted a lot, though. I didn't realize how much acting he'd done.
Yeah, well, honestly, he was in The Sopranos so much, actually, and he had directed an episode, but I thought he was far more involved on that show than he was as just an actor. So, what do I know? Yeah. I knew him more. I thought I knew him more as a director, but apparently he's been in a hell of a lot more movies as an actor than a director.
So. Yeah, and it's funny because when he does direct a movie, they're always amazing.
Yeah, and this was pretty much his first. It opened up the doors so he could do things like The Last Picture
Show. This
was
his first feature film.
Yeah.
He did a documentary prior to this, and that was pretty much it.
Yeah, and this one did sit on the shelf for a little while, though. So I think Last Picture Show might have actually come out first.
Last Picture Show was 1971.
Oh, okay, so I'm wrong. Okay, yeah. But Last Picture Show, Paper Dolls, these all happened because he made this movie.
Yes, and what was the follow-up to Last Picture Show? I can't remember the name of it now.
Me neither.
Yeah. I'll remember like 10 minutes from now. But yeah, if you haven't seen any of his films, you should, because they are always beautifully shot, including this one.
Yeah, despite the low budget, there's definitely, you can see there's a rawness to it. This is not a well-made movie, but it's a well-thought-out one. It's got a pretty decent script overall. The story and screenplay was also by Peter Bogdanovich. Story was also by Polly Platt, who was a producer on Bottle Rocket.
Yes.
Which is another great low-budget movie. It's like this one. Even a film student level could probably achieve this with some vision. That's why I always said about Bottle Rocket, if you're an upcoming filmmaker, go watch that movie, because that's something really achievable. Targets might be a little tougher because you got guns and stuff firing in public places, so you're going to have to get cops involved to work those sets. And the co-screenwriter was Samuel Fuller, who went uncredited. He did assist very heavily in this movie, but didn't want credit for it. And Peter Bogdanovich actually thanks him through character, his own character, Sammy Michaels, that he plays within the film, which is far more significant than I thought, because he's fairly low in the credits on IMDb.
Yes.
But he was,
he was one of the few I cast, actually. I only cast like four.
Yeah, I'd say he was like third bill.
Yeah.
As far as in my brain. Third or fourth bill.
Yeah, third or fourth bill. Yeah, I only cast four characters, to be honest with you, because the rest of them are kind of in and out, but there's four characters that are in it a lot.
Yeah, so his character Sammy Michaels was named after Samuel Fuller. Obviously, Sammy. I call you Sammy sometimes.
Yes.
And his middle name was Michael. So, Samuel Michaels.
So there's a sort of a backdoor credit there.
Yeah, so there's acknowledgement of his involvement and how important that was for him, too.
And I love how this film is semi-autobiographical for both one of our leads and for Bogdanovich. I mean, Bogdanovich is essentially playing himself in his vision for one of our two lead characters.
Well, this is a Roger and Corman produced film, thus the measly budget of $130,000, which Bogdanovich thought he could get, because AIP, which was Corman's company, was going to release it, and he's like, well, I'd like to see if I can sell it to a bigger company. And Paramount bought it for $150,000, so Corman was happy.
Of course,
he made $20,000 grand on the movie right away.
Right off the shot, yes. And I didn't do any connections to Corman because we've done him so often.
I don't either, especially with the producing. There's so much of that within our body of work now of our archives that I'm just, trust me, it's like every fifth film.
Yes, is the
whether we know it or not, and then we do the research, it's like, oh god damn it, there's Corman again.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, because he's made so many films that didn't do very well. I shouldn't say do very well, but aren't as well known that are worth looking at again.
And I think this is one of them because it did not do well.
No, I can imagine it didn't.
To be honest, even though we're going to remake it this episode, I still don't think it'd do well because people actively avoid things that are too real for them to face.
Yes,
and this would be one of those uncomfortable topics. Even, you know, this movie's 50 years old.
Yes, it is.
And by the time I got to the end, I was definitely, it left an impression.
It did. This is, I mean, I wouldn't put it on the same level as Peeping Tom from the same year.
No, I mean, this is nowhere close to being as well made.
No, but it still had the same kind of impact on me.
If it had that kind of quality filmmaking in there, the cameras, the higher budgets, and the more polish, oh boy, I bet you'd stand right up with the rest of them.
Yeah, and I mean, this is on the list of 1001 films you should see.
Yeah.
Right? Like, it's mostly because of the story mm-hmm. and the performances.
Yeah, the performances are good. I mean, the camera work's not great, but the positionings aren't bad. There's some bad jump cuts, and the ADR is pretty clumsy.
And there's some of that Bogdanovich's artsy shot stuff, too.
Yeah.
Because he does like to do that. He got better at it.
Yeah, no, it was definitely experimental. He would have been, I'm guessing he would have been in his 20s when he made this movie. And clearly just a young filmmaker and kind of finding his way through. But Corman's a great place to work through that kind of stuff.
Exactly.
Because the script is good.
The script is really good.
Yeah.
As I said, the performances are outstanding. Mm-hmm. Like, are the four characters that sort of carry the film are all phenomenal.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, this was one of those films that I'm sure Boris Karloff felt like, well, what I've read actually, it was one of his favorite movies that he ever did. It was a different career path for him, even though he was kind of playing himself. This movie is really interesting because the movie itself feels like the movie Peter Bogdanovich's character, Sammy Michaels, is making.
Yes. Yeah, it's very meta.
Yeah.
It's very meta, especially with Karloff playing Byron Orlok, who is an aging horror actor near the end of his career. Mm-hmm. And in this movie, he actually has decided to end his career.
Yeah, he wanted to retire. He felt like he was a dinosaur. Mm. And the world had changed around him. It acknowledges that the world is changing, and the things that scare people in the films has also changed. And his horror movies have become camp, and he's not being taken seriously. So he's kind of done.
Yeah.
He doesn't feel his own worth anymore.
Yeah, and it takes a long time for you to really get that. It's not until the very end of the movie where you understand what it was that was motivating his retirement.
I'm still not sure even now. Somewhere in the middle, he explains all that with the, you know, Mr. Boogeyman, they called me.
Yeah.
I opened the episode with that clip. I really love that clip, even though the ADR is kind of bad when it cuts.
Yeah. It's a little unclear until his essentially final line in the movie, mm-hmm. right? And even then, it's left a little bit to interpretation.
I think his story, which I'll end the episode with, the man from Sumatra facing death in that story, is part of what Karloff is also seeing. Yeah. He knows his death is coming, but it's not there yet. You know, he sees death, but nope, not quite your time yet.
Yeah.
And he feels maybe it's too late to kind of resuscitate his career, go out with a big, bold statement. And he's like, yeah, you can't retrack your career with one movie. Well,
but
we've seen in films that you can.
Yes, and this...
It was a lot harder then.
Yeah, it was a lot harder then. And the funny thing is this movie is, I mean, as you said, it's sort of out of his normal genre.
Mm-hmm.
And
I think this caps his career really nicely. Yeah. I mean, it wasn't his last film. There was a few more that came out even after he passed.
Yeah.
But it would be one of his last. When he was shooting this movie, he was down to half a lung. Offset, he was on a resuscitator, just a breather, so taking oxygen, and he needed a cane to walk around. And yet he still gave a great performance.
Absolutely, yes, there's no question. He was so strong. It was actually really fun to see him in this movie. And I love the fact that they actually used real clips from his old movies.
Yeah, well, that was part of Corman being cheap and all.
Yeah.
So they open up with clips from The Terror in this movie. And that was something like Corman
insisted on
with Bogdanovich. It's like, okay, you got to use clips from my other movie with him, The Terror. Oh, he owes me 2 days still under contract. And Karloff really liked the script, so he did the 2 days and did three more.
Yeah.
He was there for 5 days, and he didn't take any more pay other than the 2 days because he really liked the script.
Yeah, because it's such a good script. The whole idea of using The Terror was to give you more Karloff time, and his commitment to the film and the role really allowed them to flesh it out, so they actually ended up using less of The Terror because they didn't have to.
Yeah, yeah. And overall, he's probably in the movie for a good half hour, which is great because I think his story is compelling, even though I don't feel the two stories coincide very well. You've got this other story happening at the same time. This movie feels like it's happening in real time a lot of the times, especially that highway scene. So you have this young man who is part of this idyllic, almost white picket fence type of family.
A very 50s family rather than late 50s 60s.
Nuclear's family, yeah. Mm-hmm. He's talks to his father and calls his father sir. Mm-hmm. And he's very respectful, and he goes out on hunting trips with his dad. And there's stuff I read that I didn't even get in the movie that this kid was had come back from Vietnam.
There's only one clue to that in the whole movie, where he's in his father's office and he's looking at the photograph of himself in Vietnam.
Okay.
That was the only clue that he was a Vietnam vet.
Yeah, I think we need a little bit more than that.
Yeah, yeah. Because I think the intent of, part of the intent of this movie was to address the trauma that Vietnam veterans suffered when they got home, the vilification and the hate that they received. For a lot of these young men, they didn't volunteer. They were drafted. They didn't have a choice.
Yeah.
And they still got treated poorly when they returned.
Yeah, it was a lottery. They would pull a month and pull a ball, and if it was January 6th and you were born on January 6th, you were going to Vietnam.
Yeah. Exactly. And that's very timely now as well. I mean, they don't have the draft in the United States anymore, but this unyielding hate that people have for certain groups of people, whether it be Vietnam veterans or Iraqi veterans or somebody of a different color or different religion, this unyielding hate is still a thing. Mm-hmm. And it's fucking ridiculous.
Yeah, and I'm not even sure if it's hate if more than a fear.
And that's part of it too. You're right, fear is part of it, but it's still ridiculous.
Oh, absolutely.
It's still timely even though it's 50 years old.
Mm-hmm.
In that sense.
Yeah, and there's so much of this movie that still plays today because, fuck, it's still happening.
Yeah.
If anything else, it's happening more.
It is happening more, almost on a daily basis.
Yeah.
Right? And we haven't touched base on the theme that's where we're concerned that make people uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. Is one of the two, our two sort of central characters, Bobby, is suffering from some sort of trauma. He is broken.
And he knows something's wrong. He even tries to talk to his sister about it.
His sister or his wife?
His wife.
Yeah.
For a while there, I thought it was his sister.
Because there's that odd thing where they're living at his parents' home.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's broken. And the very first time you see him, he's looking down the scope of a rifle at Byron Orlok, the character played by Boris Karloff.
I mean, from a gun shop, he's buying another weapon with a cachet of them already in his trunk.
And I mean, that's another thing that we want to talk about in there is how easy it was for him to buy these weapons.
Yeah. Before we do that, though, let's run the trailer and catch some people up. It's more about Bobby in this trailer than Karloff. They don't even mention him in this trailer, but I'm glad we got to talk about him at the forefront of this, because I think these stories get equal time.
Yes.
We thank you for the food we're about to receive in the Lord's name. Amen.
Amen. A typical American family at dinner. Mom and Dad, their beautiful daughter-in-law, and their only son, Joe, a homicidal maniac.
Hey! What are you doing?
How's your dad?
It's okay.
There you go. Thanks a lot. What you hunting this time?
I'm gonna shoot some pigs.
Targets, a movie about a war inside a man's head. Bogdanovich, the director of The Last Picture Show, takes you for a roller coaster ride through the canyons of a disturbed mind in Targets. What turns an all-American boy into an all-American killer?
And we still don't know.
We really don't. We don't know what happened to him. There's no backstory on it.
No, there's more information in that trailer about that kid than there was in the movie.
Yeah, because they never really tell you what broke him. But in case you didn't gather from the trailer, Bobby, the younger character in the film, he is struggling with something and ultimately ends up going on a killing spree.
Mm-hmm. And you don't even see him really break. It's just this, yep, today's the day.
Yeah, well, he plans it.
It's very planned. Yeah. It's
very, very planned.
He scouts the oil tower and
purchases an awful lot of weapons.
And lunch.
And lunch.
Yeah, because it just feels like he's up there playing a video game. He's having a good old time. It doesn't feel serious to him, which just adds to the tension of that scene.
It does. That and there's the first time you see him where he's looking through the scope at Byron, like it's almost foreshadowing.
Yeah.
Right. Like, I mean, well, no, it is foreshadowing. And then there's that scene.
Yeah, because those two are going to inevitably meet near the end of the film.
That's right. And then there's the one scene where he's out there. Him and his dad are out shooting at cans mm-hmm. and targets and all that stuff. And he sits down on his father and you see his finger tightening on the trigger. You can see that there's almost like whatever happened to him made him enjoy killing.
Mm-hmm.
Like he discovered something in himself where he enjoyed that aspect of being a soldier
mm-hmm.
and he misses it somehow.
Yeah. And again, not enough of that is made clear about his past.
That's kind of what I inferred from it.
Yeah.
Is that he discovered something in himself that isn't healthy and she should have been able to get help for, but instead he acts on it.
When he does try to talk to his wife, she's got to get ready for work and go. And you get the feeling that maybe, just maybe, if they had had that discussion that day, then maybe that the rest of that movie wouldn't have happened.
I think that's what it was trying to tell us, yes.
Yeah.
Right. But instead, it does lead to the final events, which only happened in like the last 25 minutes of the film. Like, it's a long lead up to it.
Yeah, this movie's fairly short at 90 minutes, but it does take a while to build up to that point where he starts indiscriminately shooting at people on the highway.
Yeah. Which is a horrific scene. Like, it was really uncomfortable to watch.
It is. From one standpoint, I was like, well, you're targeting the people through their windows in a moving object. You would have missed every time. But I can see why they would do that for general audiences, just because that has a better effect for the audience if it's the target's actually on what he's shooting at.
Yeah.
Even though that's not the way it works.
No. Yes, and they actually mentioned that in some of the notes that I read on the movie. Yeah.
Yeah. What's interesting about it, like, he's not a perfect shot. He's a really good one.
Yes.
But he doesn't hit every shot. And we're so far away because we're over his shoulder and seeing it from his point of view. We're not hearing the chaos. You might hear some screeching in the background, but you're not hearing the screams.
Which makes it actually more uncomfortable.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and if you didn't notice, there's no music in this movie.
No, there's none.
So that also adds to the realism of the moment.
And the discomfort that you feel through most of the movie.
Yeah.
It's a very discomforting movie. If you feel up to it, I would recommend seeing it.
Yeah. That's part of what Karloff's story helps, is he's just a surly old horror actor, and it breaks the tension.
There's some really great moments of levity when Byron and Sammy get drunk together.
Yeah.
And the when they wake up the next morning in bed together.
But I wish his girlfriend Jenny was like, what's going on here?
Yeah.
Honey, it's not what it looks like.
Yeah. But there's that great scene where Karloff sees himself in the mirror and does the jump start at himself. Like, oh. Which was improvised. So, I mean, again, just goes to show how talented Karloff really was. Right? Mm-hmm. He sees his moments and takes them.
Yeah, and that wonderful Man from Sumatra story that he tells to the radio jockey. At the beginning of the movie, he's like, I'm done. No more movies. I don't want to look at a script. That public appearance, cancel it. Him and his agent and the studio are fairly at odds for the beginning of the film because he's so stubborn about this decision he's just made.
Yes. Yeah. And they're talking about suing him. And
he doesn't care.
He doesn't care. No. He's
done. It's funny.
Yeah. Yes. The only thing that he feels at all bad about is his assistant, Jenny. Who is, I think, our fourth build lead, I would say.
Yeah.
Because she plays an important part in the movie. Because she's his sounding board and his assistant and his friend.
You know what I loved about that? Her in general? Like, I just liked her character in general.
Yeah.
But here is this Asian character, his assistant to Boris Karloff from England, shooting American movies, dating a Caucasian man. This is 1968.
Yeah, it was very forward-thinking. I mean,
this is not a big thing now, but this is 1968. I'm like, hey, good on you guys.
Yes. Yeah, no, and I did enjoy that. I'm like, this is really nice. It's just to see that they were already looking at interracial relationships and casting Asian actors as Asian characters. And there's this great running bit between Jenny and Byron about how she's teaching him Chinese. I love that. They had this dynamic, right? And like I said, and I do believe that they were friends to the point where they could argue and he could say mean things to her that you would say to a friend, not to an employee.
Yeah, right? No, she often saw through Karloff's bullshit.
Yeah. Yeah, because she'd been with him obviously long enough, and there were these moments where she kind of got this sort of glimmer in her eyes. It's like, Byron's fucking with everybody.
I don't think she understands what's going on in his head.
Oh, no, she does. There's a point in the movie where she...
Oh, that's she gives him, bitches him out. Yeah.
Why aren't you telling people why you're quitting?
Yeah.
Right? Right, because they've had the discussion.
Yeah.
Right? But she respects his wishes and keeps quiet. Again, part of their friendship and their relationship as employer and employee. But yeah, I would actually would like to have seen a little bit more of her in the movie.
Yeah, and that's something we could change. Like, I feel like this movie could lend itself well to being a little longer. You know, I don't think the tension would break too much at even 2 hours.
I would agree with you on that. It'd give us a little more character.
Yeah.
Certainly with Bobby's character, you need to give a little bit more insight into why he's broken the way he is.
Yeah, and I want to see what's going on with Orlok in general, like what's led to this decision. Maybe it is because he's near the ending of his life and he's sick or whatever, because Karloff certainly was.
Yes. Right. And yeah, I mean, you could certainly use that as a motivation, or I mean, I kind of like the ambiguity of his reason for leaving, but at the same time, you could give it maybe a little more freeple to just sort of infer their own things out of it a little bit better.
Yeah, well, I honestly, like with Bobby too, there's just something about some average dude going on this spree that's really scary, and
yes,
that's part of the commentary on here. This is not a horror movie we're covering. This is a thriller with a actor who is in horror movies.
Yes.
And here's a character with Bobby who's far scarier than anything that actor has played.
By all means, yes. Absolutely.
Part of the commentary. Yeah.
Right. And this guy looks like an insurance salesman, which is his supposed job in the movie. He's clean cut and he's well dressed and he's very normal, almost average looking.
Yeah, and probably from a fairly respected family within the town because people know them.
Yes, yes. Right. I mean, when he goes in to buy his last batch of ammunition, they say hi to him, but they call him by name and he asks if he can put the ammunition purchase on his father's account.
And they'd be known in the store if they're avid hunters or whatever,
yeah.
And we do see the animal heads on the wall and stuff.
Yeah. And that's where this is actually a good segue into one of the things that's really important in this movie, was with the show. They show specifically him going to multiple gun places to buy weapons, right? Showing how easy it was, especially in 1968, but it's not changed that much in 50 years, where somebody can go purchase long guns quite easily from multiple stores, so that you could have more long guns than maybe you should have quite easily without anybody knowing, because he just made the rounds and went to all these different stores to buy the weapons he wanted, right? I mean, certainly handguns and automatic weapons and so on, or semi-automatic weapons are much tougher to get, but I know that there's different rules in different states regarding long gun registries and all that stuff, but we don't even have a long gun registry in Canada, right? So anybody can own as many rifles as they want, which is quite terrifying in reality.
Right? I mean, this guy had a small armory. He had handguns and several rifles with the viewfinders.
With scopes and, yeah.
Scopes. Yeah. And it was pretty scary just when he opened the trunk. It's like, oh boy. And that's part of the tension too. You see all those weapons and you know something bad's going to happen in this movie.
Yeah. And yeah, and we had a sort of pre-warning as to what the content of this movie was before watching it, and it was still uncomfortable. Right, but if you were to be in like a new audience just and had not heard or not seen anything about what this movie was about, you would be going, what's going on, what's going to happen?
Right? And Bogdanovich took this script from the headlines.
Yes.
Like, there was a sniper in a similar situation in 1965, but I could say 73, I could say 80s.
Because say 2019.
I could say last week.
Yeah.
That's how often this happens.
Yeah. So, and that's what's really quite terrifying, is that what's happening in America right now is not a new thing. And I shouldn't even say America, because it is a worldwide phenomenon. It's just that it happens so frequently in America.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not criticizing America. It's just a fact.
You know, you watch this movie and you realize it's 50 years old. And you're like, what does it take? What does it take?
Yeah.
Well, when I mentioned this to you, you hadn't even heard of it.
No, I had not. No. No,
and
I hadn't.
And yet it's on the 1001 movies you should see before you die.
Yes.
So there's something here. Like, people should know about this movie or see it. And if nothing else, out of an educational standpoint of like, hey, when do we say no more?
Exactly. Because everybody's acting like this is, well, I shouldn't say that. I mean, it's been an issue and it's been in the media, and people in the United States have been fighting for better gun control for a long time.
Mm-hmm. And I urge you guys, in your elections, I don't want to get too much in the soapbox, but vote for somebody who doesn't get funded by gun lobbyists.
Yes. Yeah.
Simple.
Right. And I mean, I do know that we are seeing a change in the climate. I mean, the NRA is now becoming a less powerful organization within the United States. They're suffering their own issues and own scandals and their own issues within their own political structure that have weakened them. And that's not a bad thing.
No.
It is not a bad thing. I believe that people have the right to own a weapon, but I think that that needs to be controlled.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's far more legislated here in Canada, and it's still probably too easy.
Yeah, as I mentioned, the long guns in particular,
yeah.
Right, where we did have a registry where you had to register the serial number on your rifles, mm-hmm. right, which made sense to me, right, because you could raise flags. Well, this guy's got 40 rifles. What's he doing with them? How much mm-hmm. hunting is this guy doing,
mm-hmm.
right? So there's something to be said for that. They're not saying you can't have them, but we're going to be watching.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I'm not a big fan of the whole Big Brother mentality either. But there is a balance, and public safety.
I mean, some people just collect guns. I have a friend who's got a lot of guns. That scares me. I don't like guns, but he's got a lot, and I think he just likes collecting them. He takes them to the range sometimes, yeah. But he seems he's level headed.
Yeah, and there are some people who enjoy firing a weapon and collecting them. And I'll be honest, there's a certain beauty to some guns. Like, when you mm-hmm. look at them, there's an elegance and something about something that's really intended to cause harm to a person or an animal. Or I understand the appeal, even if I don't share that appeal. That was a weird place to go.
Yeah, anyway, that was our soapbox moment. But
I don't think it'll be the last one.
It probably won't be, but trust me, it would have been far worse if Trish had been here.
Yes.
But it is an important topic for this film. When I think about this film, I'm like, the only reason I want to remake it, because it's not very well made to begin with, but it's a great script, and it's still a great script.
Yes, yes. And the subject matter is important.
Yeah.
Right? Because it is a commentary on so many things.
Yeah. I still don't think it would do well theatrically. It might do well as a critical darling.
Yes.
An Oscar type of film. If that film had been better shot, given a little more money and time, Karloff might have got a statue, or at least nominated for one.
I will say, of all the Corman films I've seen, this is probably the best one. There's no question to me that this is, in terms of story and even production,
mm-hmm.
I would say this is easily one of the best, not the one of the best one I've watched that was at all associated with
Corman. Yeah, that's down to some that quality that is in Bogdanovich.
And Karloff.
And Karloff, for sure. But there's times where it's just like there's some cringiness to transitions. And like I said, just things they do badly. The film stock's not very good. Yeah. And fine. That's it. I mean, it's part of the era, and you made it with a cheap studio. So if they would have added a zero to that with a bigger studio, but I doubt they would have hired Karloff to do it.
Or Bogdanovich, for that matter.
Bogdanovich had no track record.
Yeah, none whatsoever. So, yeah, and like I said, and that's why I said specifically Corman films.
Yeah, I mean, for a Corman film, this one's... But, you know, Corman movies often surprise me for what they wind up achieving in the film for very little.
And that's part of Corman's success, is producing maybe not great movies.
He must be a great salesman. It's like, hey, do you want to do this movie? I have a bag of chewing gum. I'll feed your dog next week.
Yeah, he has a gift for getting the most bang for his buck, for sure. There's no question. But
why don't you stay at my house and swim in the pool? You know, and then everybody does the movie and they're like, wait a minute, I didn't get paid.
There's some of that for sure. He was a genius of that. And I don't think people realize how much influence Corman's had on the film industry, because like you said, every fifth movie it seems like he's attached to somehow.
Yeah.
Right. Like, he started so many careers.
And he's really good at pinching a penny. Yeah. Like, the sparse family home, which says something about it, that family as well. Bobby's family. Well, the Thompsons.
That was deliberate.
Yeah.
That was very, very deliberate. Like, the use of the color on the walls and the way it was set up and the small sparsely rooms.
Decorated. Yeah.
It was very deliberate to add
some claustrophobia to that scene. What people might not have noticed is that room, that house, was just redecorated for Karloff's apartment. Hotel room.
Again, saving a penny. That's
repainted it and redressed it.
And and off you go. You can't tell. Really.
You shoot from a different angle. No, you can't.
No.
Yeah, and that's the thing. There's a large portion of that movie that's happening in one location, just it's redressed, and a couple key other ones. I mean, the problematic one is our final scene with the drive-in.
Yes.
Because drive-ins don't exist as much as they used to, especially near bigger cities anyway.
Yeah.
You still get them in the small towns, and I think they're a little more plentiful in the States than they are in Canada these days. Ours blew up with the Hub Oil in town when we had this oil refinery that blew up, and it took the drive-in with it.
Yes, because they were right next door. And it's unfortunate they never did rebuild that, because there's something to be said about going to the drive-in for a film.
Yeah, and well, it shows you the different experiences that in 1968 with the drive-in, they had a lot more families and stuff in those vehicles than probably used to be the drive-ins, where it was more young couples. And
yeah, well, it's funny, because when they saw that scene of the playground underneath the screen, I remember those.
I do remember seeing that as well.
That actually was also one of the things that made me uncomfortable, because we'd already seen what was happening with Bobby, and the highway scene had already happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and then he fled because
the cops were starting to show up. Yeah. So, and he leaves in a hurry. He leaves guns behind and ammo behind as he's he's got plenty to go. But, and that was a weird scene to me, because he does escape in his vehicle, but a cop car does turn around and tail him. But what information did the cops already have at that point?
And you know, I had that same question,
the only witness he killed.
Yes. And I think that it was one of two things, and I'm inferring because they don't really tell you. Is one, they saw the direction he'd come from and felt that was a logical follow up, right, because of where he'd come out of. The other thing too is Bobby's established right at the beginning as a reckless driver. He drives fast, he drives unsafely, so it may have just been one of those things where a cop sees him on driving unsafely and is going to pull him over. But because of what Bobby's done, it turns into something else.
Yeah, well, it also seems unlikely a cop would have turned around for this erratic driver if he was already being called to that scene.
And that's the flip side. And the only thing that I could think of was that because the driver of the police car saw where he pulled out of and went, oh, wait, that parking lot's right behind that where we think the shots came from. So we're going to stop this guy.
Just down to a cop with good intuition, which makes me wonder if maybe there needs to be another character somewhere within this film, a third story.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see how we could fit that in.
I mean, it's not necessary, but you could have that middle ground story with a cop or something.
Yeah, I just don't know where you'd fit that in earlier in the film, because you wouldn't really understand why he's in there until the last act, right? I mean, as it is, it's really hard to make those connections between Byron and Bobby, because the stories run parallel, but the only connection that you get in the movie is when Bobby drives past the drive-in and reads the sign that says that Byron's going to be appearing there.
Yeah. What if it's like a cop who's been assigned to protect Orlok in his public appearances.
You might be able to make that fit in. Make that fit in, yeah.
But nah, that'd be studio hired security.
Yeah.
No, that wouldn't work. There might be something like there could be a presence maybe at that theater with such an open space, but we're probably not doing that now.
Well, no, I actually had an idea for that.
Okay.
I had an idea for making that work, because drive-ins are making a bit of a comeback, right?
Okay.
So he could be there to christen the reopening of the drive-in, because that's what's happening in the movie. That drive-in is actually reopening in the movie.
Okay.
Right? It had undergone upgrades and redevelopment, and I don't understand why there was a hole in the screen if they'd done that, but but you can use the same precept. It's like the reopening of an old drive-in.
Yeah.
Because
why was the door under the screen not locked? Like why was he able to get in there?
Yeah. Well, yeah. There's and that's one of the flaws in the film is there's a few implausibilities.
Yeah. Bobby climbs up above the screen and that he finds a sniper perch. So
yeah.
As the film kicks in, he just, anytime a light goes on in a car or somebody steps out, he takes a shot.
Yeah. And I love the way that they establish the use of noise. So the noise from the refinery, interesting, refinery movie theater, refinery drive-in theater. We just talked about that. But yeah, he's using the noise from the refinery to cover up his gunshots. And it's not until after he shot a number of people that one of the people working at the refinery comes out and then hears just the echo of them. And goes, well, what's going on here? And ends up finding Bobby and getting shot himself.
Yeah.
Right. And then, of course, the
I don't know if you were like me, but it was like, don't stop. Don't. Yeah. I was so into this movie.
Me too. Me too. Yeah. This is one of the movies where it had my entire attention.
Yeah. I'm not sure why one guy was working at the refinery, but that's all the budget could afford.
Yes. And it may have been one of those things where yeah, it was a weekend and he was just there to monitor.
Yeah, and that's most likely because it didn't, even the traffic on the highway was fairly light.
That's right.
Thank God.
Yes. The use of the noise from the film itself, which was The Terror.
Yeah, it was The Terror.
It was one of Carlos' films and a Corman film.
Yeah.
And a very early appearance by Jack Nicholson.
Yeah, I don't even remember seeing him, but I definitely heard the voice.
Yeah.
Which is interesting. So if you go back and watch The Terror, it's a really early Jack Nicholson movie. And Corman actually suggested that Nicholson play Bobby. If that were the case, this is one of those times where like Bogdanovich fucked up.
Yeah.
Because if that had been the case, we'd all fucking know about this movie.
Yes.
But Nicholson's career was also exploding around this time too.
Yeah, about the time this movie was initially released, he would have been shooting Easy Rider.
His career bump might have happened differently or later, but we'd probably know about it.
Yeah, probably, yes, yeah. And I'd like to talk, we haven't talked about
the cast. Did you hear Regis Philbin, by the way,
on
the TV?
Yeah.
I'm like, I couldn't believe he was active even then.
Yeah, I know, he's been around for a long time.
Yeah.
But yeah, we haven't talked about the cast at all yet.
No, in fact, yeah, normally I follow that from the trailer, but let's do that. Of course, I mentioned this was starring, directed, story, screenplay, all Peter Bogdanovich. Peter Bogdanovich played Sammy Michaels. Tim O'Kelly was Bobby.
And I am genuinely surprised that this man did not have more of a career, because it was such a low-key performance, because he didn't have a lot of dialogue, but you really felt the tension coming off this guy.
He was a series regular on the original Hawaii Five-0, but
no, he was only in the pilot.
Was only in the pilot?
Yeah, he played Dano in the pilot, and then he got recast.
Yeah. Okay, well, there you go. I mean, yeah, a lot of these people didn't have like big credits and careers, but you do kind of wonder why, because there's some great performances, at least in our four main actors in this movie. Boris Karloff, also very important in this movie. We have talked about Boris Karloff before, episode 16.
The Mummy.
No.
No?
That was How the Grinch Stole Christmas.
Oh.
And episode 61 was The Mummy. Mummy.
Yes. Yeah. I missed the Grinch Stole Christmas.
That's okay. I got your back.
Yeah. It's okay. I might have a couple you don't, so.
Nancy Husu, no, I butchered that, was Jenny. And she was in The Wild Wild West, which was, kind of cool. We might have to cover that someday. James Brown, no, not that one. It was a series regular on Dallas a little bit later in his career. He played the father, Robert Thompson Sr. He was the father of Bobby. Sandy Brown was Kip Larkin, the radio host. He was in Leprechaun 2.
He was funny looking.
He was a weird looking dude.
He was a weird looking dude.
Yeah. Arthur Peterson was Ed Laughlin. He was the agent.
Yeah, he was the producer.
The producer. Yeah. Okay, he was the producer. You might see him in the original Mission Impossible, not the film, the television series. Mary Jackson was Charlotte Thompson, which was Bobby's mother, and she was in The Exorcist 3.
Twice, apparently, because they re-released that re-edited version just last year, or actually earlier this year, I think.
Oh, I didn't know there was a there's two versions of 4.
But. Yeah, no, they did a re-release called Exorcist 3 The Heretic.
Oh, all right. I'll have to see if that's in my box set. Maybe I'll do that for 31 days. Tanya Morgan was Eileen Thompson, which we've established was his wife, even though for part of the film I thought it was his sister. I'm like, wow, they're really close.
Yeah, creepily close, yeah.
And Monty Landis was Marshall Smith, and he was surprisingly in episode 180.
Real Genius.
Was that the one?
No, I got one more.
Oh, well, I stopped there. So
okay, because this movie features an early appearance from Frank Marshall. He has no dialogue. He's just a kid in the phone booth.
But we've talked about, he was. Yes.
But he directed Arachnophobia, episode 145.
Oh, there you go. See, you know, there's couple of directors that came out of this movie.
Yeah, and the only reason I did Frank Marshall is because I knew we talked about him before.
Right.
I'll go see what...
I did actually see it in there. I'm like, I don't know if that's worth mentioning because I didn't even spot it. Yeah. So.
Yeah, no, and the only reason I mentioned it is because...
was a connection. Yeah, I mean, now that I know what it was, yes, I did spot it because it was important.
Yes. Yeah, it was. But yeah, that was our cast.
That was our cast.
I mean, it was a much larger cast because there are a lot of, like, one-line characters in the movie.
Yeah, and that's just it. Like, when we did our recasting, we really, like, I focused on Bobby, Orlok, Sammy, and Jenny.
That was it for me.
Yeah, I actually got a couple more, but I think. Yeah.
No, I just did those four because they're the ones who really drive the story. Everybody else is our general interactions that I mean, they drive the story to a certain extent, but they're not the story.
Yeah.
Right? And those characters can be filled out with up and coming actors just like this movie did. Well, except they didn't, most of them didn't come.
Yeah, exactly.
That sounded odd, but sorry, there's a distraction there.
Sam was distracted by this squirrel that jumped on my window. So.
Well, it's because he's fighting with a crow. There's a crow and a squirrel having a battle royale outside Jay's window right now.
It's an epic battle of nature outside our door. There
we go. Now back to Rat, speaking of squirrels.
Okay, well, let's throw some ideas at this. Like I said, the script's really tight, and I don't want to mess with it too much because I think Bogdanovich gets the point across really well already.
In the end, absolutely. Really motivation for both those characters.
I want to change that opening scene. It opens with shots from the Terror, and then we pull out to see Orlok in the studio watching the end of it.
Yes.
Discussing next scripts and things like that. I'd like to pull out, and maybe it's a different movie, like something earlier. I mean, are we... I guess if we're doing it present day, we can pick the movie or whatever, but I want it to be about 20 years earlier or 15 years earlier, just to... give a time frame where this kid grew up, and I wanted to pull out and it'd be a young Bobby, because that end scene in the original film, even though it adds to some importance for Karloff, it's kind of silly.
Yeah.
Without some
context.
Yeah.
And I agree with that because there's a point in the movie where Bobby's excited that he saw Orlok.
Yeah.
Right. And then he makes a point of looking at the marquee for the drive-in that announcing Orlok's appearance. Yeah. But you don't get the sense that there's a connection there really.
Yeah.
It feels a little forced. It's one of the few things that felt forced.
I want him to less of a fan and more somebody, this kid who was scared from those films.
Yeah.
Because he reacts, he's calm throughout the movie with doing these horrible things at shooting at people indiscriminately, emotionless, until he sees Orlok coming out of his limo and just calmly walking up to him the same way he's walking in that movie. So he's looking back and forth, and he sees Karloff in the movie, and there's Karloff in real life, and back and forth, and he's shooting wildly. This guy who's right in front of him, he shouldn't have missed, and then his either gun jams or he runs out of bullets, and then Karloff whacks him with his cane, yeah, and disarms him and just beats him with his cane.
And I love the fact that he ends up essentially being the hero, right?
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, and the kid goes fetal.
Yeah. I think, yeah, establishing that this actor's performance has had an impact on this kid.
Yeah. Right? So there's a different type of drama there that, you know, he reverts for a moment back to this childhood memory of this horrifying man on his television screen,
yeah,
or the film screen. And I do like that idea. I just think it needs to be established earlier in the film. And it's fucking frightening again when the cops pick him up and he's like, I didn't miss that much.
Yeah.
And that was the last line in the movie. And I'm like, good God, this guy
is genuinely broken.
Yeah.
And it just really, really makes the movie, like, it's a really great, like, sort of pinpoint on the movie. The whole point of the movie was this kid is really broken.
Mm-hmm. He wasn't even expecting to survive the day.
No, there's this really interesting note that he leaves, mm-hmm, right? Saying, yeah, I've killed my mother and my wife, and I know I'm not going to get away with it, but there will be more killing before I'm done. And it's typed in red ink.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I think that was a really interesting visual that they chose to use, because the old typewriters used to have a choice of black or red ink.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that he chose the red specifically says a lot about the character.
Yeah.
Because it's obviously not traditional, and red's kind of that color you associate with blood and violence and all these things that he's about to do. Again, that sort of goes to show, even as a first-time feature filmmaker, Bogdanovich really had a great sense of visual.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Even with the budget he had.
Yeah. No, I kind of like the idea of, like, that initial scene, we pull a note from the TV, maybe the kid's, like, ducking behind his covers, and he's watching it with his family. And that way you can establish, when you see them older, that was the family we saw at the beginning of the movie.
I think that's a better way to go. It doesn't diminish the movie in any way, and you can handle Orlok's retirement scene slightly differently then, right? I don't think it's necessary to have them looking at the dailies from his newest film. Yeah, I like that a lot, actually. I think that adds some dimension to the character and really sets up that final scene really well, like really well. This is a source of childhood trauma for our character, who's obviously suffered more trauma since. Yeah, I like it.
Mm-hmm. And honestly, you wouldn't be doing a public appearance that so close if you're just watching dailies so quickly, so at least in today's structure, so it doesn't make a lot of sense. He'd be gearing up for press tour.
Yes.
And maybe that's where the discussion comes, where he's like, I'm not doing it, or whatever.
Yeah. So we could have him gearing up for the press tour and mm-hmm, have it start with this opening of a reopening of a drive-in, playing one of his older films.
Mm-hmm.
And it still ties it all together. It still gives us this great venue for this for the final act, because that drive-in really is the, I don't want to say great setting for this type of thing, because it's a horrible setting for this kind of thing, but it's a fitting choice for it. It works really well for the movie.
Yeah. And I mean, thematically speaking, this actor who was at the top of the game when he's doing this is now kind of degraded into these B and C movies and been typecast and is having trouble to escape it.
Yeah.
So that's kind of part of his story. And maybe rather than doing a big red carpet, this kind of cheesier appearance would kind of make sense, because this is something he needs to do to pay the bills.
Yeah. And given those types of movies, he probably would have been sort of the king of one of the kings of the drive-in era, right?
Mm-hmm.
So to have that sort of have it reviving is a great counterpoint to the decline of his career too. Yeah. I like where that goes.
I don't know if we pull it from, because if we do it contemporary, you could still pull it to the 80s when slasher movies and things like that were big. Or if we pull it back to the 90s, then maybe his heyday was in the 70s.
My casting actually works really well with today.
Okay, perfect. Mine does too. So
it works really well with today,
but actually. Yeah, so I like that you think about the actors from those 80s movies. Yeah. Now they're kind of at that age where Karloff was, maybe a little younger, about 10 years younger, but I think Karloff was in his 80s when he shot this.
Yeah, he was pretty close to it. Yeah.
Yeah. My actor that I've picked is in his 70s, early 70s, but I think it still works.
I don't know exactly how old my actor is. I just know that he's perfect.
I think he's 72, but I think he's also perfect. Yeah. We might even have the same guy. Who knows?
We might.
But I think that opening's important. It establishes something with the kid that relates back to our actor, because we want these seams to mesh up a little bit better, because it does feel like almost two different movies that are happening at times.
Gives them a better connection, because it's the one thing that really is missing is that connection between the two, but like where the mm-hmm. two these two parallel stories, they finally intersect, but they don't, the importance of it isn't there. Like mm-hmm. you don't sort of get that sense of importance that this, it's important that they intersect.
Yeah. In fact, I like the idea of your opening credit crawl being classic horror movie posters and marquees along with these horrifying headlines over history from this guy's heyday. And we can kind of see this growth and collapse of his career as the world is changing. Because horror does that often. Horror has always reacted and changed to the way the real world is and what the real world reacts to.
Yeah, for sure.
That is acknowledged within this movie, even though it's not a horror movie. It's something that you can embrace and should embrace and see how things have changed and how different and scarier the world has gotten.
I like that. Yeah, and then lead into a scene from one of the movies from our horror actor, mm-hmm. whether it be a real movie or a fictional movie.
Yeah, and that'll be up to the studio. Yeah. I mean, part of it, I really wanted to use a real one, but it's like, okay, well, this actor's stuff is over with this studio, but the movie itself is Paramount. Yeah. So I'm like, nah, I'll let them sort it out.
Yeah, that's exactly
it. This is part of fantasy casting. I'll do it the way I want.
Exactly. Yeah, no, it's funny. I knew who my Orlok was. Like 5 minutes in the movie, like, I know who I'm casting.
I knew it before I started. Because I had an idea of what the movie was about. I knew enough about it. I had never seen it, but I knew enough about it that I'm like, oh, this guy could pull it off, no problem.
Yeah, see, and I always like to sort of see the at least part of the movie before I make any decisions. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it comes because I know the movie really well, but because this one was new to me, I wanted to wait and see.
Yeah, I didn't write anything down. Yeah. I didn't commit myself until I actually saw the movie, because sometimes I'll have ideas going in and then it's like, oh, that's not quite what I thought it was going to be. So it does change your dynamic. And honestly, the horror actor is about the only one I thought was easy, because we've done so much of it on this show.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree. We'll save the rest of the casting for when we're ready. But
we're almost ready.
Yeah, we're almost ready.
We still got a bunch of movie here too. Work, well, maybe not a bunch, because like I said, the script's good. You throw a little bit more money at it to work out the seams a little bit, contemporize with the way the studios work. I mean, that's the way things worked in the 60s aren't the way things work now.
No, for sure.
In fact, if anything, they're busier and bubblier and two cell phones in any hand for an assistant. So
yeah, exactly. One of the thing that I would not change at all is, I mean, there's this predilection now in modern filmmaking to be very graphic with violence. Mm-hmm. One of the things I really loved about this movie was how bloodless the violence was, mm-hmm. because everything was so remote and distant from our killer.
Yeah.
Right. He never really saw the effects. He saw people falling, but he never saw what was really happening to them.
You could do a distance effect if you wanted to, but it's not necessary. Although at the same time, it might add to an audience's discomfort if they saw a suggestion of a blood spot or something, because you are so far away.
Exactly. So, I mean, I don't want to go like completely, I wouldn't say no, completely bloodless. So you want a certain amount of realism.
Yeah. And I don't really want it close up. Although that one scene where the kid's staring at his dad in the car and the dad's dead next to the window as it pans over. Whew. Yeah. And even though it's bloodless.
Exactly.
Which doesn't make any sense. There's not even a hole in the windshield, so maybe they get a little bit more suggestion in there, take a little more care, but that says a lot.
Yeah, it works so well without being graphic. And that's what one of the things that made this movie really impactful.
Yeah,
for
I don't
me
want is, to see heads explode or whatever, but you know, you could see suggestions of that violence.
Yeah, and exactly, but you don't need the overly graphic blood sprays that we get nowadays.
Because trust me, it's still disturbing all on its own without having to do that.
Yeah, exactly. I think it actually was genuinely more disturbing because it really emphasized his distance from what he was doing.
Yeah.
There was no connection between the damage he was doing and his actions.
Yeah, and at no point, and that's something the film's always got to be careful about, and I think Bogdanovich did a good job, and if a remake would ever happen, it's got to be a director who's going to also do that, because you can't glorify this.
No.
You've got to make the message has to be, this is awful. We need to maybe take a look at the mental wellness of our veterans or just anybody who buys a gun. It's like, hey, there should be a closer look at anybody who buys a gun and whether they're even mentally fit to possess one.
And I think that's part of what this movie was trying to convey even 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and as far as sort of establishing sort of, I don't know if we need to know what sort of what broke this character, but we need to do a little bit more to establish that he is unstable. I mean, they do a good job of it in this movie, but I think they could have done a better job.
You kind of get the feeling he's just going through the motion. This feels like a family that's pretending to be a good family, a tight family.
There is some of that.
It's almost like they're hiding their darkness.
And certainly by the fact that he calls his father sir, that I think that he resents the domination of his father,
mm-hmm.
right, to a certain extent. And
he, you know, I don't want to go into the cliches of an abusive home or whatever. Sometimes people are just nuts.
Yeah. Yeah. And there
aren't any triggers, and yeah. You can't explain it, and that's terrifying.
And yeah, I think that's a good point, is you don't want to go too tropey with what's mm-hmm. happened with him, right?
There'll be this desire from any filmmaker to explain it and soften it and make it a little more relatable to the audience. Oh, well, he was beaten as a child. Well, that makes more sense why he's all fucked up.
Yeah.
Or abused.
No, and I think that showing him in what most people would consider a normal, happy household, it, again, just adds to the impact of the message. There's nothing wrong with his family. Mm-hmm. It's this man who's broken. And it was, we don't necessarily know what broke him. Because let's face it, I mean, you'd never really know what broke them. We had recently in Canada, we had those two young men who went on a brief killing spree up in northern BC and ultimately took their own lives. But nobody's ever going to really know what motivated them to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I think that not knowing is, again, maybe a little too real for some people,
mm-hmm.
but it's a reality. And I think maybe leaving that fairly ambiguous might actually be a better way to go.
Yeah, because of that ambiguousness, the only connection I want to make is more to Arlok.
Yeah.
So there is some fears there, but what makes him do this? You can see those final, like, that's, this movie isn't about his lead up to it. This is the day, or the day before, when this movie starts.
Yeah.
Like, he's already made up his mind.
Yeah, this is like, all happens within 24, 36 hours,
yeah.
maybe. I want to fix the thing with the car where the cop car chases him. And I figured it out. There's more than one guy working at the refinery,
mm-hmm.
and he sees him pull away in his car. He calls the police and says, yeah, I saw a car pulling away from the refinery there. I saw him get in with his bag of guns, right? It's a simple fix.
Yeah. You would think, especially modern day, there'd be cameras all over the place.
Exactly. Yeah. Especially on something like a refinery. Yeah.
Although they'd probably see him going up.
Yeah, you could easily explain that when he's going in, he knows where the blind spot is, mm-hmm. but in his rush to get out, he runs through camera sight, right?
Yeah, or he just does a little more research and dresses the part.
Yeah.
Makes it look like he works there.
Yeah, I mean, that's an implausibility you can kind of work your way around. Mm-hmm. But yeah, just explaining really big one where why does that cop stop and chase him without adding a whole new character?
Mm-hmm.
And trying to fit him into shoe him into the story, I think that's an easy fix. Is you have security staff either from a security desk or from a remote security or whatever calling and saying, yeah, we saw the guy come over the fence, so I'm getting into this car with his license plate number.
Yeah,
boom. It's a simple fix. 30 seconds of dialogue.
I'm game for that.
Yeah, it fixes that. What is it, to me, is the biggest hole in the movie.
Mm-hmm. I think we need a little more work on Arlok as well for our movie, just because I wanted a nod to the man. I wanted, because the Arlok is a reference to Nosferatu.
Yes.
Back to the founding of horror. But I'd like to rechristen the character as Karloff.
I think that's a good idea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Since he's not around to make his cameo, it just seems appropriate.
Yeah, we call him Byron Karloff instead of Boris,
yeah.
right?
Yeah. Yeah. I am totally down with that. I think just it's a good nod. But I feel like we need to understand the man a little bit more and where he is a little earlier in the film, mentally as well, where he's just like, oh, I'm tired of making this trash and nobody's taking me seriously anymore and this is a terrible way to go out, but it's not going to get any better. So
yeah, and I mean, there's that point in the movie where he kind of does do that,
mm-hmm.
but it could have gone just a smidge further, mm-hmm. right? I think that...
It should come out when Jenny's yelling at him more.
Or with the scene with Sammy, actually, I think would be better. Because Jenny already knows why he's leaving, right?
Right.
But Sammy comes in and Sammy's confronting him and he's drunk and he's unruly and he's...
I think he's seen this man. He's idolized this man. He's written movies for him before and he's finally
as a movie he thinks is worthy of the actor.
Worthy of it. Because in a way, I think he sees this man as a father figure.
Yeah. And he also, I think he also understands. So he's hurt. Yeah. He also understands subconsciously why he's leaving, because he's been doing these low budget crap films when he's capable of so much more. Mm-hmm. And I think, and that's what the Sammy character really is to convey, is I get you. I get your disappointment. I get what's happening to you, mm-hmm. without ever saying it.
Yeah.
Right. That's why I wrote this script for you.
Yeah.
And there's this sort of constant reminder that Orlok's never read the script.
Yeah.
He didn't read it when it was handed to him. He still hasn't read it by the end of the movie. He's never read it.
Yeah.
Right. That could be part of that final bit of dialogue from Karloff, right?
Here's a thought that might soften the blow, because boy, when that thing ended, I was like, huh, kind of left breathless.
Which is good.
It is good. So, but I like to do another pan out right there with another audience doing a standing ovation for the film they just made about this script, which was, because that's kind of what just happened.
Yes.
They just don't do it.
Yeah, it's
this movie is the script that Sammy wrote.
Yeah, like I said at the beginning, this is a very meta script.
Yeah.
There's
in a way, it does kind of just, allows you to breathe again.
Yeah, it without necessarily diminishing the impact of the movie. Yeah, I could see that working.
Pulling out at the premiere, who's to say that all didn't happen, but that you can leave ambiguous to the audience, because it doesn't lessen the impact of the importance of, and the message of that story, at least the Bobby side of the story.
No, because the message is still there.
And it gives us a nice roundabout happy moment that there still was a future left in the twilight years of our horror actor. So it gives you, despite all this darkness you've just felt, you have an uplifting moment with him.
Yeah, because his final line is pretty dark. I mean, it's just...
I wasn't happy leaving it there. Yeah. Although, I did like Karloff's line after he beats the crap out of him. Yeah. It's like, what was I afraid of?
Yeah, this is what I was afraid of?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's...
And the pathetic nature of this coward.
Yeah, and that's my one concern about that sort of alternate ending with the audience, is does that make that moment less powerful?
The old man who beats him with a cane in its own right.
It does. Yeah.
I mean, I'm not even happy with how that plays out as it is. So yeah. I do like where the kid just kind of, I think our opening
fixes that a little bit. Yeah. Yeah. Unquestionably.
Yeah. If our actor's a little healthier, maybe he can get a little more physical with him.
Yeah. Yeah. I think so. I don't know. I'd be happy with either ending, but I think I would just leave it with it where it is, but maybe add one sort of last little bit with our Karloff character who just saying, Sammy, where's that script? I think that would work really well without...
Yeah, that's good too.
Yeah, because I think giving them the audience, it's almost spoon-feeding.
Yeah. And your closing credits could be something similar to the opening, where I had this montage where it's like, okay...
Where they're filming it?
Maybe filming it, or just shows the opening advertisements for the film, like print ads and posters and marquees, big success, awards to this film, counterbalanced with the more violence that's not ending.
Yes.
It's still out there.
Yeah.
This one guy has been caught, but it's still, the problem is still there.
Yeah. The constant headlines. Yeah.
Yeah.
I like that. I think that gives you sort of that, again, that the contradiction of the two stories is so important, and that just really emphasizes at the end and still emphasizes the message.
Mm-hmm. And part of this is like, yes, things happen in the world that are really dark and horrible, but you still got to live your life.
Yeah. Yeah. And look for those moments of brightness.
Yeah.
Right.
You can't grab onto to the darkness all the time.
Yeah. No, I love the idea. Yeah. Karloff returns in triumphant new picture, an Academy Award winning performances, and I love it.
Mm-hmm. It gives us that happy moment as well, if you stick around for the credits, because everybody does now. You've been trained to because of Marvel movies.
Yes.
And you don't even have to wait. It'll just happen within the credit crawl.
Yeah, I like that. And I mean, we don't really need to, with all that, we don't even need to change the middle of the movie. We just need to sort of...
And not much. No. Like I said, a lot of this works. It's just badly made. It's well written. I think it's badly made.
Well, I think that's maybe a little harsh. It's well made within the budget it had.
Okay, I will give you that. For the budget it had, it is pretty decent. It's a decent watch for sure.
Yeah.
but given more money with that same script, this movie could have been way better.
Oh, absolutely. I don't disagree with you at all.
It's cut by amateurs. I mean, there are times where it's just like my inner filmmaker is just like, oh, come on, this is awful. Like, you've got this great script and some great performances, and then you hack it up with these bad cuts and bad ADR. And I mean, the angles weren't even that bad, but the editing was terrible.
Yeah. And again, like I said,
the film stock was terrible. The audio quality was terrible. I mean, granted, there was a lot of ADR, all that stuff on the tower. They didn't shoot audio on, so it was all inserted what was there. The refinery noises and things like that. So they were completely building that soundscape.
Yeah, and I mean, you could tell.
Yeah.
Right? I mean,
and that's the problem. You can tell. Even if you don't know anything about filmmaking, you can tell.
Yeah. It wasn't bad enough to jerk me out of the movie.
No, like I said, it had an impact on me. This is a great movie made by Roger Corman Studio, AIP. I mean, it really is. It's like an Oscar death race.
Yeah.
You know, like, here's this great movie made by the guys who made Death Race. Like, what the hell?
The movie itself is a contradiction.
It is. It's like another 100 grand, man.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think it would have taken much to move it from a great story in an okay film to a great story in a good film, at least.
Yeah, I mean, it's clearly made on the cheap.
Yeah, no, there's no question of that. You can tell by the way it was shot, and like you said, the ADR and the edits are definitely the weakest points of the film.
Yeah, and this is a prestige piece.
Yeah.
Like, it is something that would garner attention from the Academy.
Yeah, no, this is...
Given a good performance.
Yeah, this should be in the class of Peeping Tom. I keep going back to that one because that was a benchmark for me in terms of...
But that one's incredibly well made.
It is, that's exactly it. It's incredibly well made, and it's my benchmark for movies made in this era because it just is so stellar and stands out so clearly. Mm-hmm. Right? This had that potential to be one of those movies.
Yeah, as far as thrillers go, it's right up there, and it's probably one of the best thrillers you've never seen.
Yeah.
Most people don't know it exists, and hopefully, if nothing else, we've made you more aware of its existence, and the relevance of the film still holds a lot of merit.
A lot of merit. Because
more than it should 50 years later.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, our treatment of veterans is still not improved in 50 years. Our handling of gun laws has not improved in 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Laws that were written in the Old West.
Yeah. Prior to
the Old West. Yeah. Like, time has changed, the world has changed, and those laws should change along with it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. All right. Let's get some recasting.
Yes.
Because the soapbox was starting to go glow again.
Yes, yeah.
Oh, get on it.
Yes, it was. Yeah, I think we've established how we feel about that.
Yes, but we gave you fair warning. All right, I'll start out. Give Sam the tale today.
Okay.
All right. For my casting, my Byron, my Orloff now, Karloff, Byron Karloff, is going to be Robert Englund.
Okay, I can get behind that.
You can see that, yeah. I mean, he's in his 70s. I mean, he's got a lot of energy. I hope I have half that energy. I don't have half that energy now.
Yeah.
But he'd be a very different guy, but I think he could pull it off, and especially given a movie with meat on its bones. There are some hidden gems in his own career that I may have mentioned in 31 Days of Horror, but he's got some hidden gems where you could really see him, his acting chops.
Yes, and he is a good actor.
He is, yes. For Bobby, I went with KJ Apa from Riverdale.
Okay.
I still wanted that clean cut look. And I did cast Eileen, his wife, because... Because I wanted to, because I'm like, well, I got one Riverdale actor. So I went with Madeline Petch from Riverdale as Cheryl, because I just wanted to see Archie killed. Which sounds horrible in the context of this movie, but...
Yeah, and we didn't say anything about the fact that, I did. It's quite a horrific scene, even though, again, it's quite bloodless.
Mm-hmm.
The scene where he kills his wife and then his mother. Mm-hmm. And then he lovingly takes him to and rests him in the bed and covers up the blood. Like, so there, and that's really telling. And
I didn't think so much about his brother, though.
No, that was the delivery guy.
Oh, it was the delivery guy.
Yeah.
They look so similar.
Yeah. I was
wondering where that guy came from. Like, who was that?
Yeah, he was delivering groceries.
Oh, so he just left him crumpled in a corner.
But for the people he loved, he took the time to put them in their bed, covered up the bloodstains with a towel.
Yeah.
Right. Like, so
he is very meticulous. Yeah. Like, when he was laying out his weapons, everything's clean. I mean, but the house tells you that.
Yes.
And the way he presents himself and what he wears and that sort of thing. He's, in a way, he's a very much American Psycho guy, just in the 60s.
Yeah. One more thing, before I can interrupt your casting, I'm sorry. But one more thing, because we talk about his job, but he's out shopping for guns when he should be working. Mm-hmm. I think maybe.
Well, you said he was insurance. I'm like, I didn't even know that.
Yeah. They talk about it in the movie.
Okay. I just didn't garb onto him. Like, yeah. You never see him do normal things.
Exactly. And I think that's important, is the fact that he should be working, but he's not.
Yeah.
And I think that might be the breaking point. The breaking point is, I think he lost his job.
Right. Or maybe we should see that.
Yeah. I think that would just give us that last piece that we need to sort of give the audiences something to grab onto without spoon feeding it to them.
I'd agree with that.
Yeah, that's sort of the falling down syndrome.
Yeah, I do like that. Okay, continue with my casting. I went with Olivia Cheng as Jenny. She's most recently in Deadly Class and Warrior. She's also been on Arrow, Flash, and Marco Polo.
Okay.
Robert Sheehan as Sammy.
Okay, I can go with behind that.
Yeah, I just wanted this guy who's a good talker, because if he's writing scripts and pitching to studios, he's got to be a good talker. He's got to be a good pitch man. Yeah. And Robert Sheehan can talk his ass off.
Yes, he can.
If you don't know who he is, he most recently was in the Umbrella Academy. Great
Irish, yeah.
Irish actor. Overseas audience might remember him from The Misfits, which is
best part of The Misfits and best part of Umbrella Academy.
Absolutely. For Robert Sr., Bobby's dad, I did cast that because why not? Peter Bogdanovich.
There you go.
And yeah, for my director, this one's going to be important. You need somebody who can really grab onto the character aspects of this and still give you that tension that this thriller has and leave you in that uncomfortable place at the end of the movie. So I went with, he's kind of a rock star at this point in the horror world, but I think there's a lot of thrillers. They're almost as much thrillers as they are horror movies. Mike Flanagan, with his upcoming Dr. Sleep, Hush, Oculus, Gerald's Game, Haunting of Hill House. That's all Mike Flanagan. He's very good at that, and I think he'd be a great person to do this film.
I would agree with that.
There you go.
I would agree with that. It's not who I went with, but I agree with it.
Okay. Okay.
So mine's going to be quick and dirty, yeah, or quick and easy. I've been getting in trouble for saying that.
I don't know why I had my four, and then I'm like, I'll give a couple more because
it felt like you should have more, but yeah. I'm like, no, I'm going to stop at four because these are really the important characters in the movie.
Yeah.
So for my Byron, I went with Sir Anthony Hopkins. And I think that you could go back to, even Hannibal Lecter, if you want to talk about a character that could really affect a young person, I think he'd do it.
Oh yeah, and I think he'd be really good. I think that character should be somebody who is associated with horror, or at least thrillers, yeah, of that nature.
Yeah, and so, I wanted to capture the elegance that Karloff brought, and that for me that was Hopkins. I'm like,
right,
the characters he plays is very different than the person he appears to be. Mm-hmm. And I thought that's why Hopkins popped into my head, but I like Robert Englund too.
Right.
For my Bobby, and solely because of his performance in Maniacs, I went with Jonah Hill.
Okay, I haven't seen the movie, so it's on Netflix,
miniseries, but yeah, the haunted, gaunt look I think would work really well for Bobby.
Okay,
because I think that his look could sort of, as he deteriorates over the course of that 36 hours, I think, yeah, the thin Jonah Hill looks really good for that for me.
Okay, I'll have to go with you on that one. I don't know. I can't see it right now.
Yeah, no, that's fair. For my Jenny, I went with Karen Fukuhara, who was in Suicide Squad.
Okay.
So
it's Katana.
Yes. Yeah. So Jenny's now Japanese, and she's teaching Byron Japanese.
Right.
For my Sammy and my director, I went with Jordan Peele.
Nice.
I figured, let's keep the meta.
I tried, and I couldn't get it to work. I even wanted to have a black actor for that part. It just wasn't working in my brain somehow. I was trying really hard.
Yeah, I knew right away when I realized that Sammy and was played by Peter Bogdanovich. I'm like, mm-hmm, I'm doing the same thing. And I'm like thinking, character-driven horror films? Who's like becoming?
Oh
like,
yeah, he's definitely got it.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, he's a little bit older than the Sammy character, but yeah, in context with the movie, It's early in his career right now, too, as far as being a film director.
Yeah, there's no age cap on when you can enter the industry. No. I mean, it might make it harder if you enter in your 40s, but he was already there in a different capacity.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, but it, like, in terms of being a filmmaker, like a director and so on.
Absolutely, no. I dig it, yeah.
Yeah. And that was my cast and director.
Yeah, no, that's...
Simple and clean. Simple,
clean, and that's kind of this movie as well, so. I think we both got good casts.
Yes.
I think more than anything else, it's this movie. The only reason I thought about remaking it was the message should get back out there.
Yes.
It's just as timely as it ever was. Yeah. It's unfortunate that it keeps coming up. This movie was actually completed in 67, but didn't actually get put in theaters until 68. So it was actually made prior to the assassinations of Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King. But it was released afterwards. These days, when something like that happens and there's anything that's in production that might relate to it, that gets pulled.
Yeah.
Now, if it glorifies violence, I can understand that. Save it for a little while. Let the audience breathe for a little bit before you throw something like that at them. But if there's a message like that and it just happens to happen, let the movie roll, because it's even more powerful at that point. Now, will people go see it is another matter, because we have such a knee-jerk reaction to things these days. Oh, how dare you? But, I mean, usually the people who complain are the ones that never saw it.
And that's usually the case. And this is one of those movies where, like you said, the message is still timely. And I generally don't think there's anything wrong with tackling this subject matter in a mature, sensitive, tactful way. And I think this movie did it.
This movie did it. Yeah. And, again, that's something... A future filmmaker, if this ever came up for a remake, has to have equal tact.
Yes,
to what Bogdanovich did.
Yeah, because I mean,
Bogdanovich is still out there. He could just redo this movie better.
For sure, yeah. Because I mean, at no point does this movie glorify what's happening with Bobby in any way.
Mm-hmm.
Like, at no point.
No,
I mean, and that's part of why it works so well, is because it's, even though it's takes so long to get to it, but when it's happening, you are genuinely uncomfortable.
Yeah, they don't really give you much. Like, even his interactions with his family and stuff feel kind of dry and forced, which adds to the disturbing nature of the character.
Yeah, because he's not connected to anybody.
No, there's definitely an emotionlessness about him.
Yeah, and it's truly surprising that the actor who played Bobby did not, I said it already, but I'll say it again, did not have a more substantial career, because for as little as he had to work with, he really does convey that disconnect and that emotionless really, really well. And it was really hard not to cast Matt Damon in that role, because, I mean, I saw him and I'm like, oh, look, there's an easy casting, Matt Damon. I'm like, no.
Matt Damon about 10 years ago.
Yeah.
I would have done that if it had been 10 years ago.
They had that same sort of all-American clean-cut look.
Yeah, absolutely. Right?
But that's why I went the way I did, because I wanted somebody who maybe would be a little different.
No, that's cool. We didn't reinvent the wheel with this one.
No.
It's just one of those cases where here's a forgotten movie that is really good and could be done better. Great script, not so great production values. Yeah. At times, I do feel that the Karloff stuff bogs down the thriller part of the aspect, but usually, for the most part, I was into both stories, but one would distract from the other.
There were points where that happened, yes.
Yeah.
There were points without it happening, and that certainly would be, I think, has a lot to do with production, where they just didn't have the time to tighten that up.
Yeah, and that's just it. They need to spend a little more time, better transitions, and better segues to characters, and more crossing of paths.
And better introductions to the two characters.
Yeah.
Right? I think that was the big thing, is that introduction. And I would love to see that opening, that scene where Bobby's looking through the scope at Byron, remain in the movie, but after we've established the trauma scene at the beginning of the movie, and then you could have him coming out of the studio after announcing his retirement, and then still have that scene, because I think that's a powerful moment. It is a good connecting moment. It just wasn't, there weren't enough of those connecting moments.
Yeah. I'm interested to see if there are any gun shops near studio backlots, but...
Yeah. Well, there's that, yeah.
In fact, it might be not even picking up the gun per se, but just looking through the scope
and
seeing how far he could see.
Yeah. Yeah, that could work. Yeah, but something along those lines, right? Like, so just making more points of connection throughout the movie between the two characters.
Yeah, that's inevitability, that rule of threes where, you know these characters are going to cross paths.
Yeah, and actually that would give us our third one, right? Mm-hmm. That opening scene that you've created, right? Mm-hmm. Because you have that opening scene, then you have the scope scene, and then you have the marquee.
Yeah.
Right? And I think that would be sufficient.
Well, and it's Jenny who talks Byron, or makes him see that, like, okay, yeah, I'll do that public appearance, and that whole thing would have played out differently if he had, well, that terrible incident at the theater would still happen whether or not he was there, but...
The ending might have been very different.
The ending might have been different, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's Byron who brings that story to a close. So, yeah, anyway, go check out the movie if you haven't. It's probably a little difficult to find, but you can rent it on YouTube and Amazon.
On Prime, too.
On Prime, yeah. So there's several ways you can find it. Physical copies have been out of print for a while. So actually, I've been told you might be able to find it in one of those cheap bins at Walmart.
Yeah, like it's bundled up with another movie kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's one of those movies that is really difficult to watch, but should be watched.
Yeah, I'm really glad I finally got to see this. It was originally brought to my attention in some horror documentary, and I was really fascinated by it because it didn't look like a horror movie, but it was certainly, at least on the Karloff side of the story, was a commentary on the changing world. And that was kind of what the documentary was, the changing nature of horror and how that was affected by the world around it. So
yeah, no, and it works, and it's still timely. Like I said, we said a number of times is how timely this movie still is.
Yeah, this is a good way to ease us into October as well. We still got another episode to go, but of course we're going to be doing horror movies all month long for October, and we're going to be joined by some friends because we're also part of the horror convention for your ears called All the Horror, happening this year, the second annual one, and there's going to be 31 podcasts dropping over 31 days, 31 different podcasts, and you can see all of those participating podcasts by following at All the Horror 18 on Twitter and the hashtag All the Horror, right?
That's right, and also on Facebook now. There's a group on Facebook.
There you go.
Just search All the Horror. It's right there. That one's open to everyone, and it's a little more free form. This is where we want people to have discussions about horror and share their horror loves and likes and memories and all that fun stuff. Also, make sure that you check out the TeePublic store. There are a number of t-shirt designs that are available. Every penny made by the t-shirt designs is going to Scares That Care. So please buy a t-shirt. There's 3 designs available now, and by the time you hear this, there will probably be 5.
Yeah, so support a really good cause. It's a children's charity, right?
Yeah, it is, yes. Supported by our friend Kane Hodder.
Oh, excellent.
Yes, so highly recommend doing that. Go ahead and purchase a shirt. You get a cool shirt. You support a charity. Who can go wrong? Yeah, so it's TeePublic.com/users/AllTheHorror, I believe. But if you just go to TeePublic and search All the Horror, all is one word, it'll come right up.
There you go. Very, very cool. Yeah, go buy some merch and support that charity. And make sure you follow at AllTheHorror18 on Twitter and the Facebook group to get in on all the fun that's going to happen all October. And of course, we'll be part of that, and we'll be doing horror-related episode every week for the month of October, as well as we're crazy. We're also going to be watching a horror movie every day for the month of October that we've never seen before as part of our 31 Days of Horror Challenge, and that's going to culminate in 2-part special in November as we recall our adventures of cinema that we annually do now. This will be our 4th one.
Yes, it will. My wife hates it. She actually said something about it this year. She says, I can't wait until October's already over because she gets a little bit burnt out on all the horror movies that we watch. Pardon the pun, but does wear her down a little bit. She doesn't love it quite as much as I do.
Well, we love it. And we know you guys love it too. Support us by telling your friends and family where to find us. We're in a ton of different places. You can follow us at Invasion Remake on Twitter, Invasion the Remake on Facebook and Instagram, and invasiontheremake@gmail.com if you want to email us. Send us your suggestions, your corrections, your comments. Just say hi. It's fine.
And we always respond. Always.
We do.
Right? Even if it's just with a smiley face, we'll still respond.
Yeah, you'll either get a thumbs up or you'll get a comment.
Yeah.
Depends if I think there's a conversation ready to be had there.
That's right. Yeah. And same with Twitter. If you comment, I'll always acknowledge it somehow. Yeah, and on Instagram. We have a couple people who like to talk to us on Instagram, and yeah, I always try to reply.
And you're not talking to some handler. You're talking to us directly. So let us know what you like, what you don't like, and, well, mostly what you like.
Yeah, please.
And make sure you tell your friends and family where to find us. We're a ton of different places. You can find that on our link tree, but of course we're on Apple Podcast, Stitcher, Google Play Music, TuneIn Radio, Player FM, Blueberry, Radio Public, Radio.com, the app, and even
freaking YouTube.
So no excuses. We're everywhere. The invasion has begun. It began 4 years ago.
It's well underway.
It's well underway. Whether you know it or not, the invasion has happened.
And continues to happen.
And you've lost.
Have they? Have they really?
You can only win by listening to Invasion of the
Ring. Exactly.
All right. Well, I think that's it for Target 1968. I hope you guys enjoyed this episode. And
Thank you for toughing it out.
Thanks for toughing it out on the soapbox there a little bit. And we get that this is a controversial subject and not everybody wants to hear it.
Yes.
But yeah, that is your option. We gave you fair warning at the beginning, so I don't want to see any complaints later on.
Yeah. If you made it this far, thank you.
Thank you. But we'll be back with something next week. We'll do a comparison. I haven't thought of what it's going to be yet, so we'll find out, because that'll be our last one before we get into our October recordings.
Yeah,
we'll. We'll catch you next week. I've been Jason.
I'm always Sam.
And she continues to be Trish. She's on a plane on the way home as we speak. Well, within 24 hours of me speaking. But she'll be back next week. We are out of here.
Once upon a time, many, many years ago, a rich merchant in Baghdad sent his servant to the marketplace to buy provisions. And after a while, the servant came back, white-faced and trembling, and said, "Master, when I was in the marketplace, I was jostled by a woman in the crowd, and I turned to look, and I saw that it was death that had jostled me. And she looked at me and made a threatening gesture. Oh, master, please lend me your horse that I may ride away from this city and escape my fate. I will ride to Samarra, and death will not find me there." So the merchant loaned him the horse, and the servant mounted it and dug his spurs into its flank, and as fast as the horse could gallop, he rode towards Samarra. Then the merchant went to the marketplace, and he saw Death standing in the crowd, and he said to her, "Why did you make a threatening gesture to my servant when you saw him this morning?" And Death said, "I made no threatening gesture. That was only a start of surprise. I was astonished to see him here in Baghdad, for I have an appointment with him tonight in Samarra.